Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for being here today. Can you hear me through this thing? You can't hear me through this thing, can you? No.
Is it on?
Let's see. I can shout if we have to.
There we go.
How about now? No, right?
It was working.
I just want you to know, compared to the technological difficulties I've had over the last 24 hours, this is nothing. So, let's try once more. If it's not going to work, it's not going to work. And you should also know this is very Egyptian. Okay, that should do it, right? Okay. If it cuts out, just let me know. So first of all, thank you all very much for having me here today. I'm quite honored to be here. And for those of you who think that all professors are one great big thing, I just want you to know, the thought running through my mind is, oh my God, Scott Marcus is sitting in the front row here. This better be good. So I'll do what I can here. So in the interest of time and accessibility, because I can go on and on about this stuff for a really long time, I've opted for a pretty short explanation of a lot of intricate aesthetic phenomena. Those of you who wish to know more about the various genres of music that I discuss are cordially invited to lay hands on a copy of my book, Cairo Pop, that I think you mentioned, in which I go into far greater detail than would be practical for this talk. It is suitable for all age groups, 4 and up. It's got no sharp edges. So let me start with a brief refresher on Egyptian political developments of the last few years, just for anybody who's not as into this stuff as we tend to be, just so you know the context for all of this. So first of all, in January 2011, mass protests in Tunisia drove Tunisia's president to flee the country after decades of authoritarian rule. Inspired by this, Egyptians similarly rose up in mass protests that brought the country's economy to a halt. In order to prevent mounting public anger at President Hosni Mubarak from spilling over into a full-scale revolution, the Egyptian military forced Mubarak to abdicate his... I knew this was going to happen. Lost the mic again. I'll let it sit for now. As I was saying, in order to prevent mounting public anger at President Hosni Mubarak from spilling over into a full-scale revolution, the Egyptian military forced Mubarak to abdicate his office and a transitional military government took over. That's point one. That's 2011, right? Early 2011. Under continued public pressure, later in 2011, this transitional authority eventually set presidential elections in which, as most scholars of modern Egypt expected, myself included, the winner was a member of the Islamist political organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, which I will hereby after call the MB, just to speed things up. This winning candidate, Mohamed Morsi by name, attempted to consolidate legislative and executive power with the MB, often to the apparent detriment of good governance. Nah. After a tumultuous year of power, we are now up to mid-2013, Morsi had more political enemies than friends, and the Egyptian populace was largely unhappy with his performance. In 2013, amid a fresh round of large-scale public protests, Morsi was deposed in a military coup led by his erstwhile Minister of Defense, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Claiming the mass protests as explicit public support for the coup, Sisi quickly cracked down violently on the MB, killing, torturing, and jailing hundreds, while his government reestablished the old guard regime that had fallen with Mubarak in 2011. Flash forward to now, Sisi is currently the president of Egypt and has continued to jail, torture, and kill political opponents of all sorts, including many people who had cheered on his coup in July 2013. How did it all come to this? How do we end up getting from point A back to point A? Well, pop music is not to blame. Do not fault pop music for this. Well, maybe a little bit, but we'll get to that. A piece of the answer lies in the way that the youth generation in Cairo is accustomed to making, receiving, and evaluating rhetorical appeals. Rhetorical appeals, the way you try to get a point across and convince people that you're right about stuff. I know you all know what this means, but I'm trying to drive home a fine point here. Ooh, is this on again? Cool. So in this area of rhetorical appeal, politics is mirrored by pop music. They both rely on emotional appeals laced with concrete facts to one degree or another. Remember, I work in DC now, so I can see this up close in a lot of ways. Cairo has been the center of the Arabic language culture industry for over 100 years, and Egyptians are proud nationalists about their pop culture being consumed by everyone in the Arab world. Popular culture, and especially popular music, matters to Egyptians. It's not a trivial thing. People might call it a trivial thing, but they don't really regard it as such. It matters to them. What happens with this stuff is important. It speaks to some bit of your being an Egyptian to know about this stuff. They take it seriously as both work and play, which is why I found it such a rich topic of study. And, of course, as Dr. Siegel introduced, I was already studying Egyptian pop music in Cairo when the 2011 uprising broke out around me. So it was my stupid good luck, as all real good luck breaks are, that I was in country and able to speak with a wide range of people about everything going on. And as I now ruefully realize, it might have been a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to talk to people about this stuff where they could really tell me exactly what they thought. When you could actually hear from people's mouths exactly what they thought about stuff that they are once again afraid to talk about in public, certainly with a stranger, and especially a stranger they know is recording stuff. It takes a lot to get that kind of trust built up, and it does not come easily. So, let me give you a brief intro to this stuff. Could we dim the lights up here slightly so they can see the screen? I know you can probably see it, but I want you to read a little bit of what comes up here. So, there are several genres of music here. You have to understand part of it as background for where we're actually going. There is an old style of music within popular music in Cairo. It's not folk music. It's stuff composed by people we can name. It is carefully done. It is recorded music. It is a kind of popular music. It's an older style. Very long story short, again, if you want the long version, my book is available. Long story short, I refer to this music as musiq al-tarab, which means the music of enchantment. There's a whole bunch of reasons why I call it that. It is associated with this emotion called tarab in Arabic that refers to, we gloss it as ecstasy in English, a sense of transportment, of being moved deeply. Not happiness, not sadness, it's not square with either of those things. It's often associated with both of those depending on what it is. All of you who've been moved to joy or tears by good pop music know what this idea is. So there is a set of aesthetic standards at play in musiq al-tarab, just to understand what is not at play and what we're going for. Deliberate pacing, multi-movement compositions. These are big, long, slow compositions. Just out of curiosity, how many people here, through their family background, have grown up hearing stuff like Umm Kulsum or Abd al-Halim Hafez or Muhammad Abdul Wahab? Yeah, a few of you. Keep your hands up if you honestly enjoy listening to that stuff in large measure. A fair number of you keep your hands up. You're trying to buck my trend here. Statistically, you do not matter. Ouch, right? Because these are all young people I see raising their hands there. Like, statistically, this is not the way things are going now, but we'll get to that. It is slow and long and multi-movement music in the sense that you would have like the Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. It has three distinct parts to it. You have distinct parts, distinct movements to a lot of these compositions in musiq al-tarab. You notice that. There is a strong emphasis on vocal artistry. You want to know all about that? Dr. Marcus is right here and can tell you all about it. There is a very complex set of aesthetic criteria by which to judge how well someone sings in this genre, how they do it in terms of breathing, their breath work, their suspension of certain kinds of melismas, the way they proceed up and down the amat, the various scales used in this music. It's extremely complex and it's not easy to learn how to do nor to perform. And that's one of the reasons why we take it seriously when someone does it well. Strength and clarity of tone is one of them. Strength and clarity of tone, I assume, is fairly obvious to everybody. That's fairly cross-cultural here. Melismatic passages, less so. You do not hold one long note the way an opera singer would in musiq al-tarab. You could do it if you had to, but it's sort of, you know, it's low-hanging fruit. Any Charlie could do that. If you want to really do this right, you know how to put these little melismas in, these little quavers into your voice at just the right time. Not like you're going to choke up exactly. It's more, it's a musical technique. A lot of soul singers are great at this. You want to know what melisma is and you don't know Arabic music, listen to R&B. They're very good at it. Facility, again, with the modes. The modes are extremely complex. I've studied just enough of them to know how little I actually know. It's extraordinarily difficult to get your brain around the entire corpus of information here just to try to create this music. And that's another reason why competent, talented singers in this genre are honored. And clarity of enunciation. I know, if you've grown up with Western pop music, you're thinking, what are you talking about? You actually have to pronounce these words right. You should be able to hear a musicotado performance and understand every syllable, every word, know what someone is saying. It should not be like your standard pop song where that's cool. Right? People are reacting in indignation. I mean, guys, I grew up listening to Bob Dylan as a second generation Dylan fan. We all love this stuff. At the same time, what in the world is he saying? That does not work for musicotado. You're not supposed to do it like that. You should know exactly what that person is singing because they should have perfect, in fact, according to a lot of authorities, you should have essentially perfect Quranic diction, the same level of perfection that you would bring to reciting the Quran. And a lot of people, Virginia Danielson has written about this, for example, a lot of the great musicotado performers, people will often tell you part of their greatness is that they studied the Quran. They knew the Quran, like Umm Kulsum and Muhammad Abdul Wahab. They had trained with their own Quranic teachers when they were small. That's why they knew why this diction was important. Is that necessarily true? We could problematize that, but it's something that people talk about, something they think of. Now, throw all that into the ash can. Let us move on. But first, as it goes in the trash can, this is Umm Kulsum singing. Every phoneme second piece, just so you understand, when I'm talking about long songs, Rabia, that second one, is a relatively short concert recording, and everybody listens to the concert recordings if they can help it. You never listen to the studio recording. That's missing the point. You want to hear the concert version where they're improvising a little bit, and they're interacting, and they're playing off of the audience. That one, Rabia, is a relatively short one, clocking in at 47 minutes. Into Omri is a full hour. I mean, any version of Into Omri worth listening to is an hour. Why would you bother for anything less than that? These are very long, complex, and indeed orchestral in many ways kinds of music. So, as I said, into the ash can. Now let's talk about the new stuff. Do I really need to read what's on the card here? We're all familiar with this stuff, right? hang on, we'll get to this. No. Like a good performer, I have to play up the audience here just a little bit. I want to point out this one gentleman in the front here who is obviously in a moment of transportment, a kind of tarab, listening to Rabi and Inta Omri, and then he just put his head in his hands when Shababia came on. Very common result. Meanwhile, what is going on in the back row? Either is dancing going on with the Shababia at the same time. He's morose and distraught to hear this stuff. There's my research in a nutshell. Big, obvious generational difference there. And we will talk about that. So, I'm going to assume that all of you are familiar with the idea of vaguely worded cliche-ridden pop songs. You are, you know, alive and not living under a rock, after all. Pop music, a number of interesting, very interesting exceptions notwithstanding, mostly functions by evoking emotional responses without getting bogged down in realistic details. Just about everybody can relate to a song that says, for example, the player's gonna play, 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 and the hater's gonna hate, 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 hate. It would be a different and less encouraging song, I might say, if Taylor Swift were to sing, "The guys I seem to date keep vanishing after a few dates, and I kind of worry that maybe I'm accidentally pushing them away because of my desire for a serious relationship. And of course, my dad says that I'm exactly like my mom, and that's why romantic life seems like a constant parade of misery and humiliation. That's why you left mom for my viola teacher." No one wants to hear that, right? TMI. Deride popular music all you want, but as a matter of fairness, we should recognize that we, the consumers of pop music, don't necessarily want profoundly meaningful lyrics. So it is in Cairo as it is in Santa Barbara. It's a paradox of pop music that deliberately ambiguous lyrics can provide the best vehicle for singers to express emotional sincerity. It's weird, but it's true. We can all hear what we want to hear in such songs because the lyrics are broad enough that everyone can hear them as a reflection of his or her own experiences and feelings. Young people in Cairo value emotional sincerity in pop music very highly, and they told me so all the time during my field research. The flip side of this idea, which no one here or there ever says, is that really specific lyrics that describe particular scenarios don't resonate with people. I dare anyone in the audience today to go home and write a hit song about, say, how they decided to cast their most recent vote for US Senator. Any takers? I thought not. From the point of view of Egyptian pop musicians, everything was going fine until January 2011. They sang their songs, they got their money. Now, to clarify, Egyptian musicians, this might not be immediately clear to everyone here, Egyptian musicians mostly earn a living the old-fashioned way. They perform concerts, usually private concerts booked in someone's home or a wedding and so on. There are occasionally publicly accessible shows, I've been to a few of them, but they are not cheaply priced, not for the average Joe on the street, and they're not very common. In Egypt, musicians know perfectly well that the upper class's social events are their bread and butter. You don't, as a rule, earn a good living by singing about the depredations of the wealthy and powerful upon the masses, not when you need the wealthy and powerful to book you for their kids' engagement parties. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. It's a basic rule of market economics. The January 2011 uprising threatened this model in some ways because the public's grievances increasingly took on a class-inflected tone about high-level corruption, economic and social policies that made no room for the poor, and the apparent calcification of a hereditary upper class in a republic. You know, Egypt is a republic. It threw out its last king in 1952. And despite what you might think reading the news sometimes, people do take that idea seriously, that we are not, they'll say, we're not a milk, we're not an izb. We're not something just handed down from one person to another. We're a republic and we have a voice. We should have a voice. Musicians who were used to sucking up to power suddenly had to recalculate. Did their loyalties lie with their fanship at large or just with the rich fans? A lot of singers who figured that Hosni Mubarak was basically immortal and would weather any storm chose to praise Mubarak aloud, you understand, in media. They would go on TV, they go on the radio, and they publicly say, Mubarak is our guy, he ought to stay, we should not get rid of him. And they hoped aloud that he would continue to be the president, at least during the early days of the uprising. It's not, at first at least, they did that. There was a transition. It's not that they necessarily adored Mubarak himself. The point here is that they saw Mubarak as a symbol of an entire political and social order that they were invested in. One of them is this fellow up here without a shirt, Ahmed Diab. Ahmed Diab has been an institution of Egyptian pop music for about 30 years now. He is long in the tooth. He's got kids older than you, probably. And he didn't support Mubarak exactly when the uprising happened. Does anybody happen to remember exactly what Ahmed Diab said? I don't know if anybody would have been paying attention to this. Does anybody, by any chance in this audience, happen to know exactly what Ahmed Diab said in the middle of the uprising? Not surprising. He didn't say jack. You know what he did? He got on a plane. He put his kids and his wife on a plane. He got the hell out of town. He went to London to ride things out. Go lie low. And as I am told by sheer rumor, I don't have any fact on this, but suppose it's a chartered plane. He just got out of there as quick as he could. Don't take a side. Don't say anything. Just let things play out. People did not necessarily take too well to this. They didn't hold it against them the way they held other things against other singers that we'll discuss, but they were not impressed, right? How do you get the money to take that chartered plane to London? All that money he got from his fans over the years, buying his records and his MP3s and the ringtones to their phones and going to his concerts. And he didn't even take a side. Of course, in hindsight, he looks like a genius for doing it. Imagine not take a side and ride this out with no real consequences of any kind. But after Mubarak fell, Ahmed Diab, like a lot of musicians in the pop music and the Shababia, for purposes here, that's just this current variety of Egyptian pop music, what you just heard in these two samples. Don't even get into what exactly its aesthetic constituents are. I think you all heard enough to have a working guess going here. It's contemporary pop music. He and a lot of other Shababi artists ended up feeling obligated to create songs, and not just songs, but also video clips. They refer to music videos in Egyptian Arabic as video clip. It's what you call a music video. And they wanted to create music video clips that memorialized the people who died in the 2011 uprising. Now, I want you to understand this. That is not the same thing as saying they wanted to support the revolution. Why not? We'll see. We're going to see that. But they wanted to memorialize the people who died, the martyrs, the shuhedeh. Shahid is martyr, right? Shuhedeh, as you'll hear in these things here and there, is martyrs. They wanted to show their respect to these people who died. Who are they? Well, we can get into that in the Q&A maybe. There's actually some fuzziness about who they're referring to. Ahmed Diab was one of these guys who decided to create a video clip. You've all heard what I just played in this clip. You understand what his milieu is. That's the kind of music he makes all the time. Here's his martyr, what I call a martyr pop video. I read about this in the book as well. Ooh, a little bass heavy. Come to think a little heavy in general, isn't it? Notice the pictures with the stripes in the corner. Not just a black stripe. What is that stripe? Red, white, and black flag of Egypt, yes. It is a flag used as a memorial stripe on the picture of the people who were killed in the uprising.
What's the name?
The speaker's gonna explode at any moment. So what is this? Sounds really poppy, right? Not so much. This is anthemic. This is a style of music that he did not make up. This is a current style for a long time in Egyptian music. Popular music? Well, it's a form of popular music, yes. It's not popular the way everybody wants to listen to the latest song, but it's a kind of music especially associated with nationalism, with songs that celebrate the nation. And of course, it easily can be adjusted in its tone for something memorializing dead people that you want to eulogize. This is so heavy and somber compared to almost everything else Ahmed Diab has ever recorded. And everybody knows that when they hear this. The difference between what they're used to thinking of Ahmed Diab for and this is quite striking. You know it immediately. Do you necessarily have to have deeply somber music with pictures of dead people? Well, no. In fact, you're going to see you don't have to, but it kind of goes along. And a lot of people release songs like this and video clips to testify to their appreciation for, their respect for the martyrs. Those of you who understand Arabic will notice that he was not necessarily saying anything specific about politics. He was not talking about what the martyrs died for, necessarily. In fact, he would probably cut his own throat first. This is a wily guy. Ahmed Diab has been around a long time, like I said. You don't last that long in a tough market by being stupid. He understands how, in some cases, he needs to say something without saying anything. That is not an easy thing to do all the time. And as we'll talk about, not everybody was equally adept at doing it, and there were blowback consequences for that. So, Ahmed Diab, like I said, was one of these people who managed to not say anything at a critical moment, and it served him well. One of the singers who openly supported Mubarak and paid for that to some degree was Mohamed Fouad. While Mohamed Fouad was not as harsh in his pro-Mubarak comments as other artists, some of whom hyperbolically insulted the humanity of the protesters, Fouad's comments looked like a public relations gaffe after Mubarak's abdication. He looked bad once the horse he was backing was gone, as it were. There is then a sense of penance in Fouad's video clip, which is one of these martyr pop songs that feels a little bit more like a Shababi song, a Shababiya song. This one is sort of on the fringe of Shababiya because this is much more of an old-style nationalist anthem you could have heard 60, 70 years ago. Most people did not go that far with their musical respect to the martyrs, as you'll hear. Fouad's song is a lot different. In fact, you might find it jarringly so. You're all waiting for the music. Feels a little different, right? I regret I cannot make the picture any larger on this, but I will be drawing out some of the stuff that you see here. Sort of a Spanish-style guitar, soprano sax over that. Michael Bolton could walk in at any moment. Again, the photographs. Thank you. So again, you've got this sort of mid-70s chill vibe going on with the music, but this is clearly a martyr pop video. Unmistakably so from the video clip. And I can always tell who speaks good Arabic in an audience or the people who look at some of these pictures like, oh, like there was a moment, I know. There's all this resonant stuff in this because he's picking up, his lyricist and he, Mohammed Fouad, are picking up on this moment when politically things seemed otherwise than they turned out from the implication of these photographs. So what is this song about? Bishabda Halek, I resemble you, is the song. It's all about one of the martyrs. It's addressed to one of the martyrs, any one of them, as looking like anybody else, looking like any ordinary Egyptian that one could have bumped into in a variety of everyday settings. And I don't know how well you're all able to see this from the unfortunately small picture I have up here, but the martyrs' published photographs enhance this impression because they're mostly not posed portraits. They're informal shots of them playing on the beach. You know, the friend takes a cell phone picture in a cafe when they're just goofing off. Lots of pictures like that. They're very immediate, and they're very off the cuff, and they feel very real and close to home. We all take pictures like that, right? It feels very much like anybody you could be hanging out with. This ordinariness contrasts with the greatness of what the protests accomplished, as per the lyrics. And the lyrics note it at the end, in a deliberately vague way. For those of you who don't speak Arabic, what he actually sang at the end, I just had to tell you that you did not shed your blood in vain. Now our voice is loud, and gone and broken is our fear. There remains in our hearts compassion, and in our nights there is a moon. But what the hell does that mean? Do you know? Neither do I. What one hopes it means, well, I can stop right there. See my point about ambiguity? It means whatever you want it to mean. It means whatever you want that song to mean, whatever you want it to apply to. It doesn't have to mean anything. That is a classic formula of pop music, not just in Shebabia, but in a lot of genres like that. And the photographs that are shown of events of the protest, there are a few, they flash by pretty quickly, and they're a little bit out of focus. None of them has any legible protest signs that indicate what the protests are about, although there are a couple resonant images that if he was keyed into. Compare this to Kairoki. Let's move out of martyr pop towards something a little bit more politically engaged. Kairoki is a more explicitly pro-revolutionary, if we can still use the word revolutionary here, musical ensemble. And in late 2011, they released a video clip entitled O Square, Yan Miden, celebrating the return of Egyptian protesters to Tahrir Square and thereby criticizing the transitional military government, which was dragging its heels about setting elections. And the object of those protests was therefore part of it. Now, I'm not going to show you all of it. I know we're getting a little short on time here, much against my expectations. But we're going to see just a little bit so you get a sense of this. Oh my God, you're not seeing it. Oy. Well, Greg, the internet got us again. Just so you understand this, my computer blew up last night. So I'm doing this on a borrowed computer from Dr. Siegel. And it's obviously achieved mixed results. Never mind what you're going to see. Just listen for a moment. He's getting people ginned up. He's reminding them of how energetic and how dynamic they were in the January 2011 uprising. Ya Miden. And here's Aida Layoubi. O Square, where have you been so long? Where were you? Pardon me for this harsh jump cut here. There's no way to stop this since there's no video for me to key into because apparently the video has vanished. But, you know, everything is ephemeral and all must pass in this life. So, we'll pick up with that in a minute. So, I was going to tell you all about the amazing images you see in this video, which are kind of staggering, but I suppose we're SOL there today. So, moving on from that, you can take my word on it. In this video clip, there is a collection of images that much more strongly and directly refer to political positions that people could take. Like, expressly, they talk about voting no on a referendum to amend the Constitution. That kind of directness of political ideology is very unusual in this sort of video clip, because usually people don't want to take any side at all. It was unusual this way. Exactly, it's been censored. CC got me. So, as emotionally resonant as those images are, at the same time, even then, the lyrics in this song are less so. You can take it from me. Kairouki avoids getting into much of the details of Egyptian politics because at that time they were getting more complicated by the day. One example of that, the 2012 presidential elections, when Morsi was elected, they were a painful topic for many people who had protested Mubarak at risk to their lives. A lot of former comrades broke with each other about whether it was better to vote for Morsi, an Islamist, or for Ahmed Shafiq, a Mubarak apparatchik who represented the old regime. The consensus among most youthful activists is that they didn't want either one, but there only seemed to be two options in the runoff election. Everybody else was knocked out. You have a runoff election with two candidates. There's your choice. Remember, these are people who had seen their own friends shot down and tortured and killed and jailed to try to get a voice in electoral politics. It was hard to swallow this idea. They had to vote for someone or no one and just stay home. It's not easy to stay home on election day when you work that hard to get on election day in the first place. Composing pop songs is hard to do about voting because you're going to make enemies. You are going to make enemies out of everybody who disagrees with your point of view. Pop songwriters have a hard time alienating anybody. It's not natural to them. It's a tall order to do. Shifting gears a little bit here. The output of the commercial music industry in Egypt is distributed through all sorts of social media channels. It follows then that politics travels the same routes. YouTube has tons of stuff that people put up there to try to absorb people politically. Egyptian actors often make use of memes that win their way around the internet. They pick up on these things the way all good social media activists do. Notably, in early 2013, actors latched onto a meme, you might remember it distantly, called the Harlem Shake, in which a video would show one person in a mask dancing and being ignored by everyone around him, only to be joined suddenly after a jump cut by all of them wearing various outlandish costumes and dancing energetically. A number of youthful Egyptians upload YouTube videos of this meme set in their neighborhood or place of business, but one group chose to film their version, as a public protest in front of the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters. It all comes rushing back now, right? Now you can take my word for it. There's a short video I had prepared here, but frankly, in the interest of time, we can skip past it. You can take my word on it that what some people said when they were interviewed about making this video is that it was a fun way to make a point peacefully without getting beaten up and taken to jail. Well, what were they making a point about, though? A point about what? What was that? Again, I don't know either. Well, actually, that's not true. I think I do actually know. Well, no, though, the last thing you saw about the Harlem Shake. What's going on there, I would argue, is a kind of protest without having to protest much of specificity. And particularly, it's protesting this image that will be familiar, I assume, to everybody if you just switch from Islam to whatever religion you're most familiar with, of humorless, priggish clerics. People who are these moralist scolds. It's a way of mocking them, of doing this vaguely erotic dance and being goofy and bizarre in front of the headquarters of the MB, just to give them a noogie, as it were. Is that an incisive analysis of politics that they're doing? Well, no, but that's not what they're trying to do. Is that a problem? Well, yeah. Because what you don't see is any protest against the larger structural problems that have plagued in Egypt since long before the uprising and continue to beset the country after the military coup in 2013. The activists who were protesting this stuff gradually abandoned substantive protests about those things as not working. And they started talking more and more about personal political issues, of feeling free to do what they want without religion oppressing them, without these moralists among the Muslim Brotherhood trying to tell them what to do. They figured that would play better. That, I would argue, did not work out well for them in the end. Why not? Well, it didn't work out for reasons that it didn't end up feeling enough. It wasn't convincing to people. Well, why were they doing that in the first place? Why didn't they take on bigger subjects? Why didn't they take on this massive economic disparity? Well, who were these activists? Who are these kids? Are they the poor kids? Are they the people from the Ashwayat, the slums, who have to come out and try to earn a living however they can every single day? No. These are activists who, for the most part, themselves come from the political classes, the middle and upper middle classes of Cairo. They're invested in the system too. They're also invested in the economic system the way it is. Does that mean they can't protest? Does that mean they can't take it head on? Of course not. They could take it on. But it's harder to do it. It's hard to do that when you know that's your bread and butter too, that you have a stake in the way things are, and that really taking on the way things are wholeheartedly would mean putting a lot of your own privilege and a lot of your own comfort at risk. That's not a trivial thing for people to do. That's hard for people to do. It's a risk most people, I think, would not take. So several weeks after the 2013 coup, just weeks after, a production company called Studio Risala, Message Studio in Arabic, released an 8-minute video clip. No, we're not watching all 8 minutes. Called Kiss the Hands. What in the world does that mean? It means, like, you should kiss their hands in gratitude. Whose hands? The military's. This was made about the Egyptian armed forces. The Egyptian armed forces didn't just let this happen. They assisted. They provided copious footage for it. Have a look. Let's chain a little secret. Sufjan Stevens' next single is going to be just like this. Maybe not. So, what is this? Well, this is fascist pop, arguably. Yeah, it doesn't feel nice saying that, does it? But that is structurally what you're looking at. You're looking at a celebration of the military regime that overthrew the elected president. Suck, though perhaps he did. He might have been a lousy president, but there was a military coup nonetheless. And this is celebrating that coup, and it's celebrating the Egyptian armed forces for overthrowing the government in the name of saving the country. And it's lionizing Sisi, as well as the military in particular. There's passages where you see actually Sisi like jogging with his troops. This is music made to support an authoritarian government. How is this becoming popular among people who had supported the 2011 uprising? Well, I would argue that what happened when all these activists were unable to bring themselves to protest the way things were economically, the large-scale problems that made everybody angry enough to protest in the first place, and wanted to talk about Islamists as being people who would harsh your buzz, people who would ruin your fun and keep you from living your life the way you want, and never mind the economic system that runs everything, they ended up drifting rightward. Those activists ended up drifting rightward toward anybody but Morsi, anybody but the Islamists will be better for us. And they ended up unable to distance themselves essentially from the old regime. They came back to the old regime. They ended up saying, support the enemy of your enemy. Now, I could go on and on about that, but probably you could make an argument, I already have done that. I can see a couple people about to fall into a coma, actually. So, rather than tell you more and more about what I think about this, I think I've made my general point there. Shall we open this up to Q&A and see what other people want to ask me about here? Challenge me on a few things, perhaps? Are there questions for those of you still conscious? Yes?
I'm just wondering, compared to like the U.S. music pop scene, it seems like there's like almost two sides of pop, like the very mainstream like kind of pop, like you were giving examples, like Taylor Swift. But then there's like this whole other side of like more like rock, like infused pop, more like classic pop, like for example, like Tame Impala, Jack White, and stuff.
Who?
Like listening to people who are headlining at Coachella like these 2 weekends, like obviously very big pop acts, but like not quite as popular as like the mainstream. I was wondering if that exists in Egypt as well, or if there's mainly like a big divide between traditional style of music and the kind of obnoxious pop music.
Good question. In fact, there are more varieties of pop music in Egypt than I have described to you today. These are the two biggest, I would say. No, that's not fair. There's a whole lot of shabby, too. We didn't even get into shabby. Shabby, it's not fair to gloss it quite like this. It's more complex than this. But in many ways, in terms of its emotional resonances, it is a sort of equivalent to country music in the U.S. It's stereotyped. Is this the reality? No, it is stereotyped as very working class, very much what the minibus drivers who tootle people around town are always listening to. And it's a bunch of people whining about their problems. Like, this is what people would always tell me. It's just a bunch of people whining about how miserable their lives are. It's like any George Strait song. Are there other... Hey, be fair. I've read Aaron Fox's book. I know what he says on this. It's like any kind of emotionally out there, working class stereotyped music. Are there other genres also? Yes, but shababia, shabi, and musica tora, I would argue, are the three pillars of the scene, and everything else is a much smaller time player. And to answer another part of your question, no, they are not entirely rigid distinctions sometimes, in ways that I still find a little bit puzzling. Because in a lot of ways, what I found most often is that people I talk to in Cairo, young people, would decide what kind of singer a person was by the kind of music they usually sang, even when they were presented with something totally different. The musica talab corpus is standard. You know, it's very standard, it's very well known. So the same way, I assume you all still know who Queen Latifah is, right? What genre is Queen Latifah? Hip-hop, right? What about when she sings I Put a Spell on You? 60-year-old song. What about when she sings a George Gershwin song, more like 80 years old? She's still hip-hop, right? Or is she? That's an open question. We don't have time to take a poll right now on that one. But in Egypt, the way people tend to answer that was whatever she's usually known for, that's what she is. So if she were to sing, they would say, as they did with other cases we talked about, if she's going to sing an old song, that's a hip-hop artist singing an old song. That does not suddenly make her a jazz act or a jazz standard act or anything like that, or an operatic act, or should take that on. They're associated with the thing they dominantly do, but people do cross over. They do create crossover music every now and again. Musica talab is stuff that people often dip into for street cred as serious musicians. Ihab Tawfiq, the guy who was just singing here and Kiss the Hands, Ihab Tawfiq, when he's not shilling for the regime, is also known as a very talented singer who's very good at the old hard stuff, the musica tarab. He doesn't make his money doing it. He makes money doing silly little songs for the most part with lots of nearly naked girls, and that's why people don't take him seriously as an artist in a lot of ways. But if pressed, they'll also tell you he is very good and he knows his work there. But also, that doesn't mean that he's a musica tarab guy. He's a shababia guy who knows musica tarab, and they don't mistake the one for the other. No. No, my research is self-selecting this way, in that the people who all want to talk about music love music. And if you're the kind of humorless extremist scold who would actually disdain music as, say, un-Islamic, you were not going to talk to me anyhow. I never even met anybody like that. And I knew Muslim Brothers. Muslim Brothers like their pop music too. Don't let anybody fool you about that. And what I did notice is that amongst the whole corpus of people I had spoken to, there were Muslims, there were Christians, they all thought exactly the same stuff. If you substituted the occasional interjection invoking Allah for Jesus, then you knew what the Christian would say as opposed to the Muslim, and everything else was exactly the same. There was broad interdenominational agreement among the youth generation about what they liked to listen to and why, and what they didn't like and why, and what they thought was trashy or vulgar or inappropriate. Between Muslim and Christian, aside, like I said, aside from the exact evocation of something theological, no, you could not have told the difference on paper who was saying what. It was quite striking, actually. Also in the back.
I'm wondering if you can speak more to this idea of fascist pop in terms of like distribution of it, consumption of it, that sort of thing. I mean, is it the sort of thing where they're playing it over loudspeakers in the middle of town? You can like that's.
Short answer is I don't have really good info on that for you because this became popular after I had left Egypt. I have not been in Egypt since June 2011. And the coup de processus de power was July 2013. So I don't know myself what all goes on with that now. And I would not be surprised if some things were different nowadays than they were when I was there in a number of ways. That said, it's hard for me to give you an answer, though, because the stuff that was popular when I was last there was so distanced from the regime in any way, the regime would never have thought of playing it from loudspeakers. It would never have crossed their minds. It's not all like that. In terms of its distribution, it's distributed through all the same music channels that one would expect there, through the internet, through the satellite music channels, and largely through the satellite music channels, because even more so than the radio, there's different ways to monetize that. As you all probably know, when you have a satellite music TV channel, or even just, I don't know, basic cable. Does basic cable exist anymore? I'm way out of date on television technology. But when you have stuff like that, there's more than one way to monetize it. You can sell the airtime for it. And how do you sell it to consumers? They can download this song. Are they going to pay for the song? Well, in Egypt, no, probably not. Because long story short, there's so much piracy, no one even knows anymore what is original, and therefore going to the producer. But you can get the ringtones. You can download the ringtones that do go to the producer then, because you have to text to that ringtone purveyor whose number you see flashing by at the bottom of the video as it screens. You can text in to the video. Like, oh my God, I love my boyfriend so much. Kisses! People do this all the time. You watch it on Egyptian music videos or watch any Arab music video channel, and you'll see a constant stream of little things that people can text for like a dollar. There's all kinds of ways to make money on it. So these things are there just like any other music, on the radio as well as on the internet and on the satellite channels. In the back and then down the front here.
Yeah, I have just one quick question and then a slightly bigger question. But first of all, is this Hakim in this video?
Yeah.
Yes, that is Hakim was the second singer, yes.
Yeah, this is him right here, right? He's on the far right, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
The one with the, yeah.
Yes.
So that's interesting that he's in this, what you're calling this, what was it, the fascist?
Amidst the reluctance, yes, one might call it that. Yeah, I'm not going to try to trademark that one like Margot Pop, but.
Okay. So I'm wondering if you could say anything about some of the people involved, some musicians, some of these pop musicians that involved in videos like this. And then my other question, which is a little bit different, is how do some of these musicians with these really strong voices, these strong voices of protest, fit into so, for example, somebody like Kanye Sam.
Right, strong political voices.
Yeah. Well, musicians that are really explicitly political and
right.
You know, that work in Tahrir Square.
Okay. Quickly on both those points. First of all, this is a slightly unusual video of this sort because it involved more A-list talent than is ordinarily available. Why it's ordinarily that way, I don't know. I only wish I were privy to those sorts of conversations. I don't know. But ordinarily, they tend to get your B-listers and your C-listers to perform these pro-military videos. This is the first one, as far as I'm aware, that came out right after the 2013 coup. And they had some A-list talent. There was Hakim that the gentleman back here mentions, is the best-known talented shabby singer. Shabby, that genre I talked about, the stuff that sounds like country music sort of to Americans. He is regarded as the single best voice working in shabby. And he is always an expensive commodity. If you want to have him play your wedding or something like that, you're going to pay through the nose for him. Costs a lot of money. Ihab Taufik, similar, like I said, very good singer, very talented, an expensive commodity. Also, he's a little fuzzy in this particular shop. Right next to Hakim is Hisham Abbas. Hisham Abbas is also expensive. He's a popular singer who does Shababia. He's also of relatively high social class himself. He went to the American University in Cairo himself as a student. So these guys, not everybody there. There's some second stringers there too. But these guys are more high profile and more highly regarded, and they lent their talents to this song, unusually so for these. Usually they get these people I've never heard of to record these things, and I think that must have had something to do with this first flush of, yes, we had the coup, we got rid of Morsi, now we can get back on track. And I have no idea what the personal politics are of any one of these people. I've never met with any of them. They've certainly never unloaded their thoughts to me. So I can only guess as to where their heads are in this, but I do notice that there seem to be fewer and fewer high-profile stars like this who want to say anything that political, even in support of the regime. Really, like I said in the beginning, it's hard to do pop music politically and not make enemies. All they want in the world is for every human being to buy their stuff. They don't want to alienate anybody. So I've seen part of this, I'm just not wanting to run that risk at all, even with a current political situation in which it's clear who's in charge. As far as political voices go, he mentions Rami Assam as well. Rami Assam is outside of all of this stuff. He's this protest singer who first got famous at the January 2011 uprising protest, where he started getting recorded on somebody's cell phone, just sort of putting some slogan, political slogans, to a basic guitar chant. And he's parlayed that into a career as an increasingly strident political protest singer. He is marginal to this industry, certainly. Is he marginal to political discourse in Egypt? Again, I honestly cannot say. It's been so long since I was there. When I was last there, he was still just known as this long-haired hippie who had been at the protests and had been beaten by the police for a while. His career has mostly existed since I was there. I don't have a clear sense of it from that reason, but I also noticed that right now he does not live in Egypt. Things have gotten hot enough for him that he is kind of sort of self-exiled to Sweden. Now, he's also making increasingly confrontational music, confrontational lyrics, that he's been criticized for by other people of the activist left as being unhelpful. You can look that up later. I can tell you where to find it if you want to read about it. But I'm not quite sure how to read that guy. He might be a little further out of the discourse than is useful to talk about, but I don't know. And down here.
The revival of Sheikh Imen. So I was wondering whether you have some comments. So it's not only his songs, I mean, not only his scene, but his songs were being taken over by Cinderella and Said Darwish. So there was a lot of backward kind of pulling from the turn of the century, but also the 60s and 70s.
Briefly filling in it right here. Sheikh Imen was the big protest song writer in the 60s and 70s. He was one of the very few. Abnudi was another one.
I beg your pardon,
yes. Nigam was actually the author of the lyrics. He was one of the big protest singers who was involved in the very hard left of Egyptian politics back in the day. And he and a lot of his comrades would be in and out of jail whenever they needed to lock up people who were talking too loud about stuff. And many years later, during the protests, people picked up these old songs that nobody had listened to in a long time in a big way, and they were rebroadcasting the old songs, and new people were re-recording the old songs. Has that lasted? Not so much. It seemed to have a moment, but realistically, in fairness to everybody, I dare any one of you to go to Egypt and record a hard left-wing politics protest song and publish it. See what happens to you. You know, people actually go to jail for this sort of stuff. It's one thing to talk about having the cops hassle you, but it's quite another to be actually dragged into a police station, beaten, tortured, and then 10 days later, when you're a bloody pulp, released. It's not a simple proposition to take on. When there's real consequences for your words and your actions in an authoritarian government, you do have to make strategic choices about what you're willing to risk. So it seems to be something of a short-lived phenomenon, although it does suggest that there's this corpus of protest music that's not forgotten either. People know it is there, and at certain moments they can and do draw upon it. So that's not to say it's gone. It has gone back onto the down low, as it were. But it's an interesting substrate that could arise given the right circumstances. Do we have time for other questions, or should we cap it at this point, do you think? Okay, one or two more, apparently. If anyone has the strength. If you don't, just tell us. Have I exhausted you?
So how many people did you interview in Egypt, and what kind of classes? I mean, like poor people, like mid-class, or like the richias? What are the ages of the people you interviewed?
I'll tell you the answer to the second part first. I interview people from every class. As a practical matter, I'd say the bulk of them came from the middle classes, a few from the upper classes, a few from the poor, relatively speaking. It was mostly a middle class thing. How many people did I interview? It depends on how you count. I did not keep count myself in a practical way because I'm a cultural anthropologist who's not terribly big on statistics. I don't do a statistical analysis in the first place. In the second place, what's an interview? This actually becomes a real point of contention if you're ever going to try to do ethnographic research in Egypt. What is an interview? You know, is it only when you sit down with a big microphone in front of somebody and you press the record button? Or could you be sitting in a car with somebody waiting for a really long red light to turn while you're going somewhere and you just chit-chat about something else by the by in the middle of your conversation about other stuff? Informal interviews are a classic technique of anthropology. And kind of a godsend when you do your work in a place as opposed to free speech and free inquiry as Egypt, unfortunately, can be sometimes these days. So what's an interview? Everybody I talked to, in a sense, was an interview because almost everybody, at least at certain points in time, wanted to give me a piece of their mind about something. Certainly in the months right after the uprising in 2011, I was constantly bumping into people when they found out I was an ethnographer, I was doing such and such project. This, and just so you understand, the Egyptians here will understand this, everybody else, this is really weird. When I mentioned this, during those months, they would tell me to whip out my notebook, like, get your notebook, get the pen, make sure you get this down, what I'm going to tell you. Usually Egyptians kind of run the other way when they first meet a stranger from another country with a little black notebook. That wigs them out usually. And for a few months, there was this period of time where people really wanted to tell you what they thought, even if you were just talking for a few minutes before you had to go meet with somebody else. So ethnographic interviewing, and the ethics thereof are a whole other topic. We don't have time to go into that further, but there's a whole lot of interviews I did in that sense of constantly talking to people in short bursts, as well as longer formal interviews, and then sustained relationships I had with people where I'd constantly be talking to them. One more question? It's not going to go yet, is it?
No. I was just going to say, do you know if there's, like, you're talking about this fascist pop music, do you know if there's a historical precedent for that? I'm just asking because I brought my act in theater class and we read this play from 1970, which is sort of a political satire on Nasser. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that circulates on the radio is this song that's in praise of the leader.
What is the song, by the way?
Well, the play is by Ali Salim. It's called The Comedy of Oedipus. So Oedipus is kind of standing in for Nasser. And it's called You're the One Who Killed the Beast. Kind of celebrating Oedipus who killed this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like celebrating Nasser for whatever.
Right.
So, and it's like a really popular pop song. Everyone's listening to it on the radio. Mm-hmm. So it just really reminds me of this hand song. I don't know what it's based on, though. So.
I would say it depends on your frame of reference. In terms of pop music, certainly there are other examples you can point to, especially in regimes that strongly control the media and can enforce that. Remember, there's a real threat over musicians' heads here, over if you toe the line well enough, you're fine. And if you toe the line poorly enough, we could keep you from singing. We could send you to jail. You might never work again. You might never be free again. We own you, is the point that some of these regimes can make. In the pop music world, that might go back How far does it go back? As soon as pop music began making pop music that leaders didn't like, how far back do we have evidence for of leaders objecting to recorded material out there? In a larger sense, this has always been there in terms of popular culture celebrating the leader. I mean, that goes back to Sumer, doesn't it? We've got panegyrics going back thousands upon thousands of years. So that's always been there. It's much more recently, I think, that people would see that as strange. There's a very long tradition of sucking up to power via popular culture. I think it's more recent that people would look at that as something odd and inappropriate for a musician to do.
So, anything else? Okay, thanks for coming.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate you taking the time. I appreciate your lasting through all this. Kudos to all of you.